Translation and purport by Srila Charidev. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 2, Text Number 6, from the chapter entitled The Symptoms of Kali Yuga. A sacred place will be taken to consist of no more than a reservoir of water located at a distance. And beauty will be thought of to depend on one's hairstyle. Filling the belly will become the goal of life, and one who is audacious will be accepted as truthful. He who can maintain a family will be regarded as an expert man, and the principles of religion will be observed for the sake of reputation. Purport. In India, there are many sacred places through which holy rivers flow. Foolish persons eagerly seek redemption from their sins by bathing in these rivers, but do not take instruction from learned devotees of the Lord who reside in such places. One should go to a holy place seeking spiritual enlightenment and not just for ritualistic bathing. In this age, people tirelessly arrange their hair in different styles, trying to enhance their facial beauty and sexuality. They do not know that actual beauty comes from within the heart, from the soul, and that only a person who is pure is truly attractive. As the difficulties of this age increase, filling one's belly will be the mark of success, and one who can maintain his own family will be considered brilliant in economic affairs. Religion will be practiced, if at all, only for the sake of reputation and without any essential understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here are some more symptoms by which we can understand that the present age that we are living in is certainly the Kali Yuga. Because each and every one of these different aspects described here have already taken place. For example, we see in India, where there are many sacred rivers, that people only are interested in going to these sacred places to take a dip in the water. As far as hearing from intelligent, self-realized souls, people are not very much concerned with this. The problem is, of course, that in many of these places there are no longer many self-realized souls, and therefore there is hardly anyone to consult. But at the same time, people in general are very fallen. The fact that a river is sacred means that it has had some contact with the Supreme Lord. For example, the Ganges River is sacred because it emanates from the spiritual world. It goes through the various planetary systems, and it is involved with many of the incarnations of the Lord's and his pastimes therein. Also, the river Jamuna is very sacred, just like in two of these pictures we see the river Jamuna, because it is at that river that Krishna had many pastimes. So because of the contact with the Lord and the Lord's devotees, rivers become sacred. And the places where these rivers flow become places of pilgrimage. That means that persons go to these places because by going there, they start to remember the pastimes of the Lord. And this is the perfection of life, when one's mind can be absorbed constantly in hearing and chanting and remembering the glories of the Lord. This purifies the consciousness so that at the time of death, one is thinking of the Lord and doesn't have to take another material birth again. So it is necessary to visit these holy places. Personally, we all experience every year when we are fortunate enough to pilgrimage to India, how purifying it is to go to Mayapur where the Ganges flows, to go to Vrindavan where the Jamuna River flows, and to hear and chant the glories of the Lord. But we must remember that in going to a sacred place of pilgrimage, that we should take advantage of the self-realized souls who generally reside at these places, We should search out such a self-realized soul and inquire from him. When we were recently visiting Rishikesh, which is a holy place, we saw many persons coming there, just dipping in the water and then going away. And other persons would go there and search out some sadhu or saintly person. But because most of the saintly persons are very corrupted in their habits, people never got real instruction in spiritual life from these so-called saintly persons, because the saintly persons were themselves addicted to sinful activity. In America, of course, there are not many sacred rivers. If we go to the Mississippi River, you know, what will we remember? Mark Twain. So instead of remembering Vyasadeva, who compiled the Vedas, you know, we have to remember Mark Twain, who compiled, you know, about Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. So this is the misfortune of these parts of the world. However, even America is becoming fortunate now, because although the rivers were not connected with the pastimes of the Lord, because of the establishment of temples just like this temple, cities like Dallas are becoming a place of pilgrimage. Now, if someone comes to Dallas and they are actually spiritually interested and curious, they have a place to come where they can hear and chant the glories of the Lord. Therefore, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness is actually making the world auspicious by establishing so many temples where the deity is being established and installed and worshipped, and where the congregational glories of the Lord are being chanted, where devotees are congregating, and anyone who comes into such a purified atmosphere can immediately become as benefited as if they went to a holy place of pilgrimage in India. Next, we read about how beauty will be thought to depend on one's hairstyle. And this is a fact. It is mentioned here that in this age, men will grow their hair long and think themselves beautiful, because it will be considered a sign of beauty to have lengthy hair for men. Of course, in the Vedic culture, especially for those who were in the spiritual path of enlightenment, in the Brahminical platform especially, men shaved their heads as a sign of renunciation and cleanliness. But nowadays, people are overly attached to their hair. And we see that the entire industry of hairstyling, cosmetics, etc., are simply meant for the purpose of decorating a body which is in itself dead. This body is simply a lump of material elements. In itself, it has no life. The life is the life force, the spirit soul, which resides within the body. And it is the soul itself which is actually the source of beauty. Because as soon as the soul leaves the body at the time of death, the body begins to decompose. It begins to give off foul odors and becomes rotten. And therefore, either it is buried or it is burned according to the religious practices of a particular person. But one way or the other, the body has to be disposed of once the soul has left the body. So the body is not beautiful, just like the famous movie star Marilyn Monroe, who committed suicide. After she had committed suicide and was dead, I don't think that anyone would have wanted to embrace her body. Although when she was alive, you know, millions of men would have liked to have done that. But why was it no longer so relishable and attractive? Because the soul had left the body. So very logically, we can understand that since beauty is equal to the, you know, the soul, when the body is there and not there is not the issue. It's logical to understand this, that I'm attracted to someone so long as the soul is in the body. When the soul goes out of the body, that person's body is no longer attractive. Therefore, it's not the body which is attractive, it's the soul which is attractive. But this is intelligence, and we have to learn to understand in this way. Therefore, generally, devotees try to minimize the external preparations of their body. They are very simple, you see. We try to reduce the need for too much bodily embellishment. Of course, for the purpose of serving Krishna, that is another matter. Just like some of our devotees are going out, they hold jobs, they hold positions of responsibility. They may have to keep their hair, they may not be able to shave their head. A woman may have to deal in the material world and use a certain amount of cosmetics because that is the accepted norm in material life. But personally, we should not be very much attached like this. We should not become overly enthused about decorating our bodies, because the body is temporary, and one day it will grow old and will have to be given up in the end. Next, filling the belly will become the goal of life. What is the goal of life? The goal of life is to realize Krishna, to realize one's relationship with God. That is the actual goal of life. But in this Kali Yuga, the goal of life will become simply to fill up the belly. That is called anamoya. The lowest kind of consciousness is this anamoya consciousness, or the consciousness of existence, remaining alive, survival of the fittest. You know, as Darwin would say, survival of the fittest is the most base conception of material existence. Every animal does that. Even little amoebas do that. But that is not the goal of life for an advanced living entity who has a human body. Because a human body and a human brain is capable of much more than simply filling the belly. And yet we find that as the Kali Yuga progresses, persons will have no time for any other concern. Just like an animal, if you study the behavioral pattern of an animal, you will see that by and large, their entire attention is focused on eating, gathering food. Chipmunk, bird, whatever you may name, constantly looking around to find some food. So as times get tough in this age, people will be more and more worried about how to fill up their belly. And they will give less and less attention to how to fill up their consciousness with God. That's why it's said that if you are born in a wealthy man's family, or if you are born in a pious, Brahminical type family, it is good fortune. Because you do not have to endeavor so hard simply to make ends meet. In that sense, we can say that anyone born in America, for example, is fortunate. Because everyone here enjoys a fairly decent standard of living. If you can't get a job, you can get welfare. So practically, there is no one who is so unfortunate that they can't even fill up their belly. And thus we see that birth in America is considered a high birth. And that's why you see, for example, so many people in India, they want to immigrate to America. Which means, in a sense, they're taking their next birth in America. Because they recognize that wealth is a sign of high birth. So if I have an American citizenship, I have improved myself. Actually, that is nonsense. Whether you have an American, an Indian, Russian, Chinese, Japanese, or African citizenship doesn't guarantee that at the end of life you're going to be any better than you were when you began. The only guarantee of real fortune is if you can end the cycle of repeated birth and death. That is actually the goal of life. To be able to end the cycle of repeated birth and death. If you can do that, you may consider yourself to have been a successful human being. But if you are forced by your material desires at the end of this lifetime to have to again go into another material body, then you have failed the human mission. So life should be arranged in such a way that gradually we can focus our attention on Krishna 24 hours a day. Everyone should make their schedule, daily schedule, in such a way that as their years progress, they're more and more conscious of their relationship with God. Next, one who is audacious will be accepted as truthful. This means that those who can be very successful at spreading propaganda about what they believe in, or about a particular issue will be considered to be proponents of the truth. In other words, for example, scientists. By and large, science is based on speculation and hypothesis. And to a great extent, many scientific facts are still theories. But a sufficient amount of propaganda and money is applied to a statement, and if the statement is repeated enough times and on a large enough scale, that is loudly enough, people will gradually accept the statement as truth. I think that we could dispute many, many, many so-called facts which are now being taught in public schools, whether under the name of anthropology, whether under the name of history. You may take it under so many different categories. There are many speculative statements which are not facts, but because they have been very broadly popularized, they're now accepted as truth. Therefore, it says that whoever is audacious, that means without the concern for credibility or substantiation, that whoever can speak audaciously enough will be considered very truthful. And if a man may know the truth, but is humble or poor or unable to surround his statements with sufficient propaganda or propel his statements by sufficient propaganda, he may be considered to be a liar. Just like who gets elected to a political office, whoever can put out the most propaganda. It doesn't have anything to do anymore practically with the credibility or value or worth of a person. Spiritual or moral worth or integrity is not considered as much as how much he spends on his campaign and how much he lies. The more you promise, the more votes you get. The fact that you don't fulfill your promise is not important. It would be an interesting analysis to see how many campaign promises are kept in political offices. I bet people would be shocked. They should make an analysis to record all the promises that someone has, you know, made, and then at the end of his term, see how many he fulfilled. I bet it's less than 50%. Much, much, much less. Because it doesn't matter. People are not concerned with truth. They're concerned with verbosity. How much you can speak, how much you can brag, that will be the symptom of your, you know, credibility. Now, one, it says, he who can maintain a family will be regarded as an expert man. And that's a fact. Nowadays, it's very hard to maintain one's family. So a man who can maintain his family is immediately appreciated by his wife. And if he cannot do so, then there is a good chance of divorce taking place. But it's hard to maintain a family. No one, however, is thinking that the highest duty of a husband or the highest duty of a wife is to give spiritual guidance to the family. We have an example in the Vedic scriptures of the Brahmin named Sudama. Very impoverished person, but very enlightened. Living in a very simple way, but giving spiritual guidance to his wife and family members. So his wife was always inducing him, why don't you go and see Krishna? Krishna used to be your friend when you were in school together. Now he's such a wealthy king. You see, if you go to see him, we can get out of this village and have a better livelihood. He'll bless you with some good fortune. Go see him. Actually, Sudama Brahman didn't want to see Krishna like that because he accepted Lord Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But his wife was pushing him so much that finally he decided to go. And he took a little presentation of some chip rice, some simple dry grains of rice. So when he went to see Krishna, this rice was offered. Krishna said, what do you have there? He said, I have some little chip rice. And Krishna started to take this rice and eat it. So immediately, the goddess of fortune, immediately said to Krishna, please do not take any more because you are the Supreme Lord. If you even accept a little bit from your devotee, that devotee will be returned millions of times the benefits which you have given through, which you have taken from him through the little bit of service. So you've already taken enough. Don't take any more chip rice. But when Sudama Brahman went back to see his wife, she was in a huge palace. And she had been blessed with so much opulence, simply as a result of offering a little bit to Krishna. The fact of the matter is that anyone who directs their family members to become Krishna conscious is actually doing the greatest benefit for their family. And their family situation will become very auspicious. Otherwise, even if you provide food, clothing, shelter for your family, every animal is doing this. What is the great, credit to you? Simply to provide food, clothing, and shelter. Every animal provides that for their family. But if you can do, in addition to that, if you can provide spiritual enlightenment for your family, then actually you've done your duty fully. We don't say neglect the family in terms of material necessities. But don't limit it to only material necessities. Do your duty materially and spiritually. There's a verse which states, no one should become a father or a mother unless they can deliver their children from the repeated cycle of birth and death. That means unless they can give them spiritual enlightenment. And if your children are already grown and unwilling to listen, then at least you become Krishna conscious. Because then automatically, if you become Krishna's devotee and are successful in going back to Godhead, the promise is there in the Bhagavatam. 21 generations of your forefathers and future family members will be delivered back to the kingdom of God. Because you've done this most significant duty of all, which is making yourself Krishna conscious. Next, the principles of religion will be observed only for the sake of reputation. That we discussed the other day. People attend a church, a temple, a synagogue. Why? Simply so that they can be counted by their fellow friends and other family members as being religious. But very rarely does anyone go and become realized in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. People go to church, they go to a temple, a religious building, simply to put on some fancy clothes, do a little social talk, and be noted that, see, I come to my place of worship and therefore I'm religious so that I can cheat you as much as possible during the week, but you won't believe that I'm cheating you. You'll think I'm a very religious man because I went to church. And that goes on. People go to church simply to get free from their sins. They sin all week, and then on Sunday, oh God, please forgive me. The soul is willing, but the flesh is weak, and therefore I had to sin, but please forgive me. And then again they go out and begin their sinning all over again. You see, and all the people who sit in the other pews and queues are all thinking, oh, he's a very good man. Did you see him? He was there. Every Sunday he comes. But what he does from Monday through Saturday, no one thinks. So people will observe religious principles simply for the sake of reputation. In India also we see that. So many people make a show of religion. It's a fashion, isn't it? People even take a spiritual master or initiation as a fashion. Oh yes, I have my guru also. You have a guru, everybody has a guru. Everybody says that in India. They know you should have a guru, so they take the guru as a fashion, like a pet dog. But the guru is not like that. And spiritual life is not for that purpose. It's very serious, a solemn affair. Grave. It's a grave matter to consider taking the spiritual master as one's guide in life and to take advice and direction on how to perfect all of one's activities. So we will stop here and give a little time for any questions which anyone may have. Right, Abhinav?
I was thinking that what could be the common factor, because one may think I'm attracted to the soul, and actually he's attracted to the body, because the body is a reflection of the soul in a certain way, no? The body is moving because the soul is inside. So one may think that he's attracted actually to the soul, but what could be the difference? What could be the understanding for knowing what is...
The way to know if you're attracted by the body of someone or the soul of someone is to see if in your dealings with that person you are carrying out the guidance of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Because the spiritual master, saintly persons in scripture, are there to direct your soul on how to go back to Godhead. So when you propose to do something, or when you are doing something with another person, and if you are concerned, is this because of my attraction to this person's body or soul, you can just see if the interaction between you and the other person follows the teachings of scripture, saintly persons, and guru. If it does, it means that the relationship is a spiritual one. And if it doesn't, it means it's material. It's that simple. Is it clear? Another question? Yes?
I want to ask you a question. If you say in the Buddha, one that become pure devotee save 21 generations, bring on the spiritual world?
Yes.
With us?
Yes. If you're in the spiritual world and they come to the spiritual world, then you're all together. It may take a little time. They got to be born first, 21 generations. But gradually, if one goes back to the spiritual world, the whole idea is, as we explained last night, in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Sarva dharmam parityaja mam ekam sananam braja aham tvam sarva papyo mukshyasyami masucha. Krishna says that you give up all other principles of religion and just surrender unto me, and I will protect you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. This statement is in the Bhagavad Gita because there are so many prescriptions in the scripture about duties a man or a woman has. Duties to family, duties to society, many, many duties, duties to teachers, this, that, many duties. So one has so many duties that one may think, I have no time to fulfill my duty to God. Therefore, at the end, Krishna finally says that you give up consideration of all these other duties as being very important, and just take up the most important duty of loving me. And if you establish perfect relationship with me, then I will give you protection from all the sins that may come from neglecting your other duties. Because even you do these other duties, you will be imperfect. You will never be able to fulfill all your material responsibilities. There will be some shortage somewhere. So then you'll get a reaction, a sinful reaction, because of that shortage in your duty. But Krishna says, if you want to really cover all your material duties, just do the one most important duty, which is to develop your love for me. Then I will protect you from all the reactions that come from any neglect to your material duties. So similarly, one is thinking, I have to serve my father and mother. I have to serve my children. I have to serve my family and society. And therefore, I have no time for Krishna or Krishna consciousness. Krishna says, therefore, in the Bhagavatam, that if you become fully Krishna conscious, then automatically 21 generations before you and afterwards will all be liberated. Because why? Because doing the duty means to help your forefathers, your father, mother, children, to go back to Godhead. So Krishna says, I promise you, if you go back to Godhead, I'll take them all back to Godhead also. Now don't worry about them. Just worry about your love for me. When he says don't worry about them, means you don't neglect them. But you first of all consider your need to develop your relationship with God. And in terms of that relationship, then you consider your father, your mother, your son, your daughter, etc. Everything that we do has to be done through our relationship with God, because that's the actual purpose of life. When it comes down to the last moment of your life, your sons, daughters, etc. are not going to be as important to you as what you've developed in terms of your relationship with Krishna. It's the bottom line. You may have so many digits in the equations, but the bottom line is how much you have developed your consciousness of God.
In developing your relationship with Krishna, we also need, it's recommended to get the mercy of the other devotees. And there's 6 loving exchanges that we're supposed to take part in. Is there any circumstance where a devotee can refuse a gift offered by another devotee?
Instead of refusing it, take the gift and offer it to Krishna, or offer it to somebody else if you can't use it. If someone wants to give you a gift as an act of love, another devotee wants to give you a gift. Yes?
Srila Gurudev, after one gives up such attachments, say family life, and he comes to, try to practice religiosity, but he fails to follow the rules and regulations strictly, should he leave his spiritual duties and go back to family life?
Why do you say that one should give up one's attachments to family and begin to practice spiritual life? Who said that you have to leave your family to begin to practice spiritual life? We never say such a thing.
If family life is not congenial to...
First of all, you should make sure if it's not congenial. You see? You have to give every opportunity to your family members to become Krishna conscious. And so long as your family members are not obstructing you in your spiritual practice, then there's no need to leave them. There's no need at all to leave them. Because that creates other problems. Just because you leave your family members, we have to see if you're strong enough to handle it on your own. Usually there's a great deal of attachment to family. And one should not renounce one's family unless one is extremely pure and spiritual. And then only with the permission of the spiritual master. As far as possible, better to stay with family. Only under an extreme circumstance should one give up one's family. Because once you do, you should not have to go back again. That is called vatangsi, or one who eats his own vomit, which is not a very palatable thought. If you have vomited or given up your family affairs, and then again you have to go back to them, that's not very good. Everyone, sooner or later, should be able to renounce one's family, just like we see in the personality of the Christian Son of God, Jesus. He gave up his family. Practically speaking, he wandered everywhere and anywhere, and he said, I have come to take brother from brother, son from father. The Christians don't believe this anymore, but that's what he said. Their own founder of their religion said this, and he demonstrated it, but they will not follow. Because you cannot serve God and mammon both. That's the statement in the Bible. That means that sooner or later, by the end of your life, you should have only attachment to Krishna. That's why it's recommended that a man, by a certain age, say 50, 60, as far as he can, should gradually free himself from attachment to wife and family. And a woman should be so strong that she can accept that principle also. But that takes gradual practice. Therefore, if you do it prematurely, it may be unsuccessful. One should not renounce family life prematurely. One has to renounce it ultimately, because at death, in any case, you're going to give up your family. In any case, by the time you die, you must give up your family. So better to do it voluntarily than out of force. Better to be prepared voluntarily than out of force. If you're too much attached to your family, then in your next birth you may have to again take birth in the same family. Our only attachment should gradually come to the point of attachment to God. Every scripture in the world states that. There's no other statement. Ultimately, that is the bottom line. Okay, so I think we'll end here. Thank you very much. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga.